From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as he left for Utah earlier today, President Trump expressed strong support for former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who last Friday pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russians.
Well, I feel badly for General Flynn. I feel very badly. He's led a very strong life, and I feel very badly, John. I will say this. Hillary Clinton lied many times to the FBI. Nothing happened to her. Flynn lied, and they destroyed his life. I think it's a shame.
But in 2016, former FBI Director James Comey testified before Congress that Hillary Clinton did not lie to the FBI. And what to make of that Trump tweet over the weekend? The president said he fired Michael Flynn because he lied to the vice president and the FBI. But did he know back then that Flynn had lied to the FBI? Something Flynn admitted to just last Friday. The day after he fired Flynn, a former FBI Director James Comey said Trump pressured him to drop the Flynn investigation. Domenico Montanaro is NPR's lead politics editor. Domenico, just jump right in on this, the tweet of the weekend, your take on it.
Well, you know, the thing is, Trump and Trump supporters feel like they found a much-needed talking point. You know, they're trying to claim Mueller's investigation is partisan, and you're going to hear a lot more about that this week. That's because Mueller removed an agent from the investigation because of anti-Trump texts. Now, Mueller removed this individual months ago, but coincidentally, the story of the text came out Saturday, a day after Flynn pleaded guilty. And the president used it to tweet an aha. He said, "Now I see what's going on," he said. So he's insinuating a broader conspiracy against him within Mueller's team. Meanwhile, you've got Democrats like Dianne Feinstein from California on Meet the Press on NBC saying that the Judiciary Committee, which she's a ranking member of, is looking at a case of obstruction of justice against the president. So Democrats going the other direction than Trump supporters.
Well, and there was talk over the weekend that FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation is moving away from Russian election hacking and collusion towards an obstruction of justice case against the president. But there's also been caution from Republicans on CBS Face the Nation. Here's Lindsey Graham. He had this advice for the president about his tweets.
I would just say this to the president. There's an ongoing criminal investigation. Comey may be part of it. You tweet and comment regarding ongoing criminal investigations at your own peril. I'd be careful if I were you, Mr. President. I'd watch this.
And Domenico, what about the news that one of Trump's lawyers is saying he wrote the tweet?
It's a very odd story. This is John Dowd, who's President Trump's personal attorney. He took ownership of this tweet. He said, "My mistake," in quotes, to Axios, an online publication. And he'd emailed Tamara Keith, who works here at NPR in the White House, and said that Sally Yates didn't say Flynn lied when she about the FBI when she approached Don McGahn, the White House counsel, but that he lied to the vice president, but that he also told the same to the FBI as the vice president. So they're trying to split some very fine hairs here, because if you logically deduce that he lied to the vice president and he said the same thing to the FBI that he said to the vice president, well, then he lied to then the president and the White House counsel knew that he had lied, if, you know, that's what he's actually trying to say. You know, and it is another strange interview that he had with Axios this morning, saying that the president can't be prosecuted for obstruction because he's the top law enforcement official in the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, is their argument really now that the president is above the law? That's what it certainly sounds like.
That's been tried in the past. It didn't go well. But let's take a look at the tax plans. Republicans in the House and Senate now have to reconcile their two tax plans. Huge victory for the Trump White House and Republicans in passing the Senate plan. We're going to take up what's in the plan elsewhere in the program. But what do you make of the thinking expressed in The New York Times and elsewhere that Republicans are setting up for a larger fight here? There is no question that at least the Senate plan is going to balloon the deficit. There's no question about that. And some are saying that that's the goal, so that the Republicans then can then cut social welfare programs like Medicaid and Medicare.
Well, that's what Democrats believe is likely, but I'm not sure there's a grand scheme here. You know, here's the thing. Republicans want tax cuts. They want to give a big win to Trump by Christmas, and they have to do it within these confining budget rules, so they only need 50 votes because they can't get Democrats on board to do this. And that's created this situation of Band-Aids, patches, and horse trading, which may eventually very likely set up a larger discussion about the debt and deficit. However, the party that's out of power is the one that tends to seem to like deficit spending.
Yeah, well, and the New York Times is reporting that many Republican lawmakers are openly talking about this plan. So we'll see where that goes. Meantime, on the agenda this week, avoiding a government shutdown when federal funding expires Friday. Will this just be kicked down the road?
Yeah, the likelihood is a 2-week extension, perhaps beyond that. That means it would expire December 22nd, the Friday before Christmas. I think I told you guys back in August or September we were likely headed for a very messy end of the year, and we are.
Okay. Trump tweeted today an endorsement of Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore. We've got that special election coming up in Alabama. He's been accused of sexual misconduct with teens. And on the same day that former Access Hollywood reporter Billy Bush today wrote a New York Times opinion piece telling President Trump that was your voice on the tape, bragging about groping women. Trump has been insinuating it wasn't. Where's this going?
Well, David Bossie, who was on the Trump campaign and was on Meet the Press this Sunday, also said that the tape is real, that he doesn't believe that Trump believes that it's fake. Billy Bush said Trump creates these alternative realities where if you simply say it, people believe it. And that may very well be a driving Trump philosophy in what we're seeing here.
Well, we'll see where these claims go. One of the women who has charged him has come forward again. Domenico Montanaro, NPR's lead politics editor, thank you.
You're so welcome.
Later today in Salt Lake City, President Trump is expected to announce a plan to shrink the boundaries of two national monuments in Utah, Grand Staircase Escalante and Bears Ears National Monument, the latter created by President Obama 1 year ago this month. The president's action will mark an important milestone for these two red buttes, which have become an outsized symbol for a slew of Western issues. Inside Energy's Lee Patterson reports.
To say the Bears Ears National Monument is controversial is an understatement.
There are parts that are worth preserving, but 1.35 million acres, bigger than the state of Delaware? Are you kidding me? It's one of the biggest land grabs in the history of the United States, and it was done...
That's former Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz reacting to the designation last year. For many in Utah, Bears Ears is about federal overreach. For local ranchers who use public lands, it's about their livelihood. And for rock climbers and mountain bikers, like the ones featured in this slick video by the outdoor retailer Patagonia, it's about preserving access to natural beauty.
There is not another place like it in the world. It's hard not to feel pride as a citizen of this country when we're in a place like this.
It's always an adventure.
For some Native American tribes,
the landscape itself represents our history. It represents our identity.
This is Regina Lopez Whiteskunk, a member of the Ute Mountain Ute tribe. Native Americans migrated through this area a long time ago, and so there are thousands of archaeological sites, sacred sites, cave dwellings, and rock art. But this national monument isn't just significant because of these features. It's significant because of how the tribes got the designation itself. In the past,
the tribes very rarely had any input into what was going to be left to them.
After a long history of the federal government taking land away from Native Americans, oftentimes through broken treaties. But with Bears Ears, five tribes formed a coalition.
We really wanted to be a big player at the table in seeking solutions.
And they lobbied the Obama administration directly. President Obama's proclamation establishing the monument is like a love letter to Bears Ears. From earth to sky, the region is unsurpassed in wonders, it reads. Against an absolutely black night sky, Bears Ears has that rare and arresting quality of deafening silence. The monument designation prevents all new mining and drilling within its boundaries, a restriction that's at odds with the Trump administration's push to open up federal lands for energy development. Further down in that document, Obama creates a commission to help manage the monument made up of members from each tribe.
This is the first ever national monument designation proposed by American Indian tribes.
Under the Antiquities Act, says Sarah Krakoff, a professor of American Indian Law at the University of Colorado. It's a law that's over 100 years old and empowers the president to create national monuments. The designation of Bears Ears, Krakoff says, is a partial act of paying reparations, a kind of formal compensation for historical wrongs.
In the sense that it's not giving them the land back, but it's giving them a management role and the ability to apply their knowledge to govern and protect the landscape.
Still, a recent poll found that a slight majority of people in Utah do favor shrinking bears' ears. And Utah's entire congressional delegation is among those strongly rooting for change. It's a feeling about public lands that's been brewing in the West for decades. Here's Utah Congressman Rob Bishop commenting last year on the Bears Ears National Monument, not long before President Trump took office.
Every 60 to 70 years, there's a paradigm shift in America on how we look at public lands. It's time for another paradigm shift.
Bishop is chairman of the powerful House Committee on Natural Resources, and he has a big stake in this debate because nearly two-thirds of Utah is federal land. He's also among a group of Republicans in Congress pushing for a major reform of the Antiquities Act, putting limits on the size of new monuments and requiring state approval. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Patterson.
And Lee's story came to us from Inside Energy, a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. If you're a devoted public radio listener, you may have heard the show The Dinner Party Download, which just ended its 10-year run. Its hosts, Rico Galliano and Brendan Francis Noonan, have just written a book. It's called Brunch is Hell, How to Save the World by Throwing a Dinner Party. They join us bicoastally, Brendan in New York, Rico in L.A. Hi, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And I have to start with the fact that I kind of disagree with your premise here, because I think brunch can be a lot of fun, especially with like a huge Bloody Mary with, you know, all kinds of, a garden of vegetables in it. But what is your problem with brunch?
I mean, maybe at the moment you're served that Bloody Mary, it feels joyous, but the hour it took you to get at that table to drink the Bloody Mary, and then the 2 hours after you have your $75 plate of eggs and avocado toast, that's really the heart of one of 2 days you're given off each week, and you're destroying it by spending it at brunch. So that's the problem.
Right.
Not the Bloody Mary itself. I support a tomato juice and vodka drink.
Yes. And it's, you know, like after that, maybe that day you were going to, I don't know, write a screenplay, or you were going to go hiking with the kids, or you were going to go visit grandma.
And now you'll
now
do nothing.
That you're, now that you're day drunk, you're just going to sit on the couch. You're going to turn on, you're going to binge watch something. You're going to hold your belly and moan. And the kids are playing with broken glass and you don't care. And it's a terrible thing that you've done to yourself and to your world.
Well, and this also gets to the fact that your book is really not about brunch. Let's be fair. It's about a dinner party.
That's true.
Which many people would say is very similar to brunch. Why do you think it's so different, a dinner party and brunch? Just because you don't have a wait?
Yeah, there's that. I mean, the most important thing is that it's more intimate. You're inviting someone into your home, which makes it more anxiety producing. But it's also what makes it special, because it's one of the few places in modern life where it's not about the commercial transaction. You're not at work. You're not at a PTA meeting. It's a completely free space. Things don't need to be perfect, but people can actually relax in a way that we don't really get an opportunity to. And also, it's at the end of the day when it's okay if you kind of yawn after you eat food. If you're a little tipsy, big deal. You can go to sleep and wake up tomorrow.
How did you two become such experts on dinner parties, by the way? I mean, you have hosted this show called The Dinner Party Download, and then you've now written this book.
We said so.
Yeah, we said so. We decided to write the. We've written the book on it, so we didn't know we had to answer that question. But seriously though, I've personally been cooking for years. My mother is a first generation immigrant, and our table was always filled with people. Everyone coming through over the years, but in reality, it really took place after college when you get older, and if you do like to cook. I just enjoyed bringing people over and creating this space. And then sure enough, we read articles in The New York Times talking about people are no longer inviting people to their homes, et cetera. And it didn't dawn on me that a lot of people have social anxiety, especially in this world of foodism where people are afraid to cook for each other. You know, they're worried about other people's Instagrams. And it intimidates them.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, like, part of it is, in fact, the fact that we named our show The Dinner Party Download. Our show, if you listen to it, isn't like dinner party party-centric in the sense of that we talk about dinner parties. It's organized like a dinner party. It's really kind of an arts and culture magazine show. But calling it the Dinner Party Download and having that vibe around it made people who were interested in dinner parties gravitate to it, and they would start asking us some of these questions. How do we have conversations like we hear on your show at a party? How do we break the ice with people that maybe are strangers and that we haven't met before?
Well, and you've got a lot of tips in this book for people who want to have a successful dinner party. I want to go through a few of them. First of all, you say that a dinner party should not happen on a Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday. Why is
yes.
that?
Yes. Well, Sunday, I mean, comes before Monday, so it's already ruined. The second half of Sunday, you're already worried about work the next day, so you're not going to have people's full attention. They're not going to be able to relax.
Well, a lot of people do have dinner parties, though, on Sunday, and they do probably associate those parties with, like, Game of Thrones or some show that's coming out, right?
it could be linked to a dinner party.
Right.
If you're inviting people over to watch a TV show, that's not a dinner party. Right. That's a Game of Thrones watching party. That's different.
And then on Monday, you're doing the things you should have been doing on Sunday, so that's not an okay night. And then Tuesdays are just dumb. Like, let's be honest. What's Tuesday night? Now, Wednesday, we're getting on hump day. People are starting to need some relief. They've dug through their emails. They kind of know how the course of their week is going to fall. And that's when we say you can initiate parties. And then we think Thursday is really the filet mignon of the week for dinner parties. It's a great night. You're not competing with a lot of other events. People are ready to let loose, and they just have to limp through Friday at work.
And if you do have your dinner party on a Wednesday or a Thursday or a Friday or a Saturday, you say make sure that you clean your bathroom.
That's right. A lot of people worry. This is one of the biggest worries that people have expressed to us is like, I got to clean my whole house and everything. If you can only clean one room and that's all the time you have, just do the bathroom and you've done at least most of your due diligence. Just get the stubble off of the sink, get the wet, you know, Sunday circular off of the floor and just make it nice and clean, because it is one of the few places, probably the only place in your house that people are going to be at some point alone with a bright light illuminating every corner. You want to make sure that that is not a horror show. If you have time, move on by all means, but that's all you have to do.
Well, actually, that gets to another point, which is you say that you don't really have to cook that much food for a dinner party as long as you cook a little bit.
Well, yeah. We say 51% of the food needs to be cooked in your home, because the dinner party is a reflection of you. It's what makes it special. People are coming to your home. They're going to see your books. They're going to be in your house, and the food should represent you. But we allow for 49% people can bring. You can ask others to bring dessert or bring side dishes. And you don't have to do a 7-course meal, actually. That 51% can really be. We promote something called stunt meat, which is just basically a big ham or a piece of pork or something that actually
roast chicken.
Cooks know this is very simple. You just put it in the oven, start drinking wine, have your phone beep, and then you take it out and you're pretty much good to go.
What do you think about the conversation that's happening at the dinner table, whether it should be one conversation or whether you should be having multiple conversations?
Well, this is interesting. We have a couple of rules. By the way, we're citing a lot of rules. At the beginning of the book, we have what is and is not a dinner party. And in our opinion, a dinner party is between 4 and 12 people. And one of the reasons is because of what you've brought up. After you have 12 people, it's very hard to fit them all around one table and share one conversation, which is really the only point of the dinner in the dinner party, is to make everybody, force them to come together in one place and share a conversation over something that they're jointly sharing as well, the food. So, you know, I think that inevitably that starts happening, particularly as people get a little bit wilder and tipsier. They might, like, break off into smaller conversations. But for at least a portion of that dinner part of the evening, I think you should be sharing conversations.
But you should not be sharing the stereo, I guess we should say. If you want to play music, don't allow everybody to have their own pick of what goes on.
No way. This is a musical dictatorship, and it is yours. Or if you have one friend who you trust and respect, you can hand over the iPhone, the records, or whatever music you're using, and we cover them all in the book. They all have their pros and cons to one person, because otherwise it's going to be a complete free-for-all. You're going to be listening to Sly and the Family Stone at 1 minute, just vibing on that, and then next thing you know, Kraftwerk's going to be playing. It's going to be very disjointed. And then you're actually going to have this feeding frenzy around the stereo with people playing songs that really undermines conversation and the kind of warm vibe and glow you want to get at the center of your dinner party.
Now, we haven't talked about one of the big elephants in the room, which is the cell phone. So are you allowed to check your phone at a dinner party?
The cell phone is the bane of the modern dinner party's existence. We actually have a number, we have a timeline of things that the dinner party has managed to overcome, challenges to the dinner party's dominance. And frankly, we're worried that it hasn't been able to overcome the advent of the cell phone, which allows you to stream kitten videos at the table.
But our proposal for the cell phone is, look, this is reality. People do have responsibilities. They do want to check in. We do have leadership that's doing erratic things at all times of night and day. So we suggest you kill the cell phone for the most part, but there will become natural lulls in conversation, or maybe transitioning from, you know, the drinks to the dinner, where, you know, allow people almost all at the same time, like, hey, I'm going to check my phone. We all do it at once, and then we proceed from there. I think giving those people those beats, and also their natural beats in a dinner party. When people are going to the bathroom that you cleaned, that's a natural time for them to check their phone. They're also going to check your medicine cabinet, by the way. So you should make sure that that's in good order, because when you invite people in your home, it's a free-for-all. So you can't ban the phone, but really not at the dinner table, not to resolve questions at the dinner table. And there's another element to this, Jeremy. In our book, you know, the heart of it, too, is about how to have conversations, because that's what we do professionally. That's what you do professionally. That doesn't come natural to a lot of folks. And we talk about how to talk to people you disagree with. And we encourage people to invite maybe someone to their dinner party that isn't just a version of themselves. We're a little cheeky in this book, but we do believe in the mission of the dinner party, which is it can enrich our lives.
Now, Rico, you're in Los Angeles. Brendan, you're in New York. I, as you know, because I've worked with both of you, have lived in both of those cities. And I remember one of the first dinner parties that I went to after leaving L.A. And going to New York. It was right around the time that the Higgs boson was discovered. And the host of the dinner party had to go and deal with the food and said, guys, the Higgs boson was just discovered. Discuss. And we did for like 10 minutes. And I thought to myself, this would never happen in Los Angeles. We would never be having this discussion in LA.
There's plenty of
professors.
No, someone
would be like, the
stuff.
Higgs boson was discovered. Someone go get the rights to that. I'm going to go order our gluten-free pizza.
The Jet Propulsion Laboratory is located in Southern California.
Fair
please.
Enough. Fair enough.
All right.
Well, when you guys are both in the same city, let me know where it is, and I will come for a dinner party. And I will not be a musical dictator, and I will not have the last piece of me. So there you go.
Happily hand off the DJing duties to you, Jeremy. You have excellent taste.
I'll try. That's Brendan Francis Noonan and Rico Galliano. They're the authors of the new book, Brunch is Hell. Guys, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
And we've got some more dinner party tips at our website, hereandnow.org.
And after years of African-American Democratic leadership, Atlanta is considering having a white independent mayor, what would be the first non-Democrat since the 1880s, the first white mayor since the mid-1970s. The election tomorrow is a runoff between two city councilwomen, the top vote-getters from November, although Keisha Lance Bottoms, the African-American Democrat, did come in November with more votes than Mary Norwood, the white independent. Stephen Fowler has been following this race for Georgia Public Broadcasting. He joins us from Atlanta. And Stephen, this is a very nonpartisan election in some ways, but it's become very partisan within the Democratic Party and others. So explain.
That's right. The Atlanta mayor's race is technically nonpartisan, which means that there's no primaries and no party affiliation listed on the ballot. But it has quickly become a partisan race because Mary Norwood identifies as an independent, and the state Democratic Party and Keisha Lance Bottoms have both called her a closet Republican, accusing her of supporting Donald Trump and even comparing her to President Donald Trump in a kind of nasty attack ad. Let's listen to a little bit of it.
Is Mary Norwood a Republican? She voted in 12 Republican primaries, and her treasurer is an unabashed Trump supporter. Norwood was even a Republican convention delegate when the biggest
So how is Norwood responding to that?
So Norwood and Keisha Lance Bottoms actually have something in common. They both voted for Hillary Clinton last November. And Norwood says she's not a Democrat, she's not a Republican, she's an independent and votes on her values, and says that it's, you know, pretty despicable. And actually some of the Democratic members of Georgia have spoken out against that ad and said, you know, that's not an appropriate use of party funds, and it is no better than what Donald Trump has done to some of his political opponents.
Mm-hmm. So there's the issue of party affiliation, and then there's the issue of race. How's that playing out?
Atlanta, for the past 40 years, has had a black Democratic mayor in what's known as kind of the machine. And this looks like this could be the first opportunity for the machine not to exist. Mary Norwood traditionally has support in the whiter northern parts of the city, Keisha Lance Bottoms in the southern, more African-American parts of the city. And Keisha Lance Bottoms, in some of the debates, has accused Mary Norwood of saying and doing some very racist things, and Norwood says that's not the case. This is Mary Norwood speaking in a debate, responding to some of the claims from Keisha Lance Bottoms.
My campaign has been a campaign of unity and unification, period. Today, we were endorsed by every one of the unions. That is a workforce in Atlanta that is predominantly African American.
So, Stephen Feller, we're going to see how this plays out tomorrow. And as we said, in the election in November, Keisha Lance Bottoms, the African-American Democrat, did have more votes than Mary Norwood, who she's facing tomorrow. But what other issues are? Are there any other issues that are being picked up here?
So there are several issues that are important to Atlanta voters. Outgoing Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed is leaving under a cloud of an ethics scandal of bribery and pay-to-play in City Hall. And while he's not directly implicated, it leaves many voters wondering if the next mayor will be as ethical as they say they'll be and if things will be above board. Another issue is transportation and affordability. With Atlanta growing and becoming more and more of a vibrant, growing city, there's problems with affordability and gentrification and people getting pushed out of their homes. And that has been a key issue that many constituents say has to be addressed before it becomes too late.
That's Stephen Feller of Georgia Public Broadcasting ahead of tomorrow's runoff mayoral election in Atlanta. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
In November, a 19-year-old DoorDash food delivery worker, Antawani Wright Davis, was killed on the job after being run over by a backing-up dump truck while riding his delivery bike. His family has started a GoFundMe page, we'll link you, to help pay for funeral expenses because Antawani had no benefits. He had no safety training, no equipment. His family was not eligible for any kind of workers' compensation because he was part of the gig economy. Workers' advocates and some state departments of labor are taking a closer look at employees who often work full or part-time, but only after signing agreements that free their employers from any responsibility for their safety. Jessica Martinez is co-executive director of the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health. It's also known as COSH. Most states also have a local branch of COSH. She joins us from San Diego. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
These are the jobs in which an employee interacts with a client digitally. We think of Uber or Lyft, you know, some of the car services. So what is happening?
So COSH groups across the country work with some of the most vulnerable worker populations, including temp and gig workers. Workers who work in the gig economy are making money but missing out on other standard benefits of having jobs. Healthcare primarily, but also paid sick leave and workers' compensation as well. Some of the issues is that companies want to meet the demand for flexible labor with minimum employer responsibilities. We're talking about no social security taxes, no health or retirement benefits, no severance when employees are laid off. It's essentially the Tinder economy. When temp worker is done with his or her shift, the boss swipes left and claims to have no further obligation.
Well, but, you know, it works two ways. We've talked about this many times before in the program that many of these employees want this. They don't want to be tied to employer. They might be young. They're not yet thinking, wait, I'm not paying into a pension or a savings account. They want this because it gives them freedom.
It does give them freedom, but one thing to note is that once they sign agreements, essentially workers in the gig economy are signing away their rights that prohibit them from exercising their worker rights. They sign away their rights and ability to speak up publicly for a host of issues like sexual harassment. Some, if not most, agreements do not allow workers to pursue civil action if their rights are violated and must go into arbitration.
Is that legal, by the way, that a lot of these workers have to sign these agreements?
In some states, there's no really legal or legislation that protects temp workers. The KOSH groups are working with several local organizations, temp worker advocates, to precisely pass bills and laws that protect workers from these agreements. One is MassKosh, for instance, that passed the Temp Worker Bill of Rights, allowing workers to essentially have access to some of the most basic information, such as the name of the agency, the worksite employer, type of work to be done, anticipated wages, right to workers' comp, how to reach the Department of Labor standards. Again, this seems like basic information any worker would have about his or her job, but many temp workers don't have this. And thanks to the hard efforts of MassKosh as a major advocate for this legislation, the Massachusetts Temp Worker Right to Know Act in 2012 passed. California, with the support of WorkSafe and SoCalKosh, also launched a campaign and got AB 1897 signed into law in 2014. It requires companies securing workers through labor contractors or temp agencies must take responsibility to ensure that workers are getting paid, are provided with a safe work environment, and that contractor is paying state and federal taxes.
We know also that in 2016, the Washington State Department of Labor and Industries ordered the San Francisco delivery company Postdates to retroactively pay 2 years' worth of workman compensation premiums. So, you know, states are stepping up and getting involved. But you mentioned how many of these gig economy, true gig economy workers, as well as some of these temporary workers who come through temporary agencies, are working across several platforms. They're doing several different jobs. That's one of the problems, isn't it? I mean, how do you take a benefit from one place to another?
Correct. It's very easy to lose track of workers, and also a lot of workers and simple employer responsibilities go through the cracks. And what we're doing is pushing for government agencies that protect worker rights, such as OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, to push for duo employer responsibility, meaning that both the staffing and the host employer on site has responsibility to maintain key records to protect the workers' rights.
Well, just hold on 1 second, because when you say staffing and on site, so this is, again, an example. You're talking about agencies. So these would be temp agencies and the people that they hire out people to.
Yes.
So they'd both have to keep records.
Both have to keep records in addition to have legal responsibility to protect the worker, both in safety and also making in wages and ensuring proper worker protections.
Well, we know some other states, New York and Washington, are thinking of the online platforms, the pure gig economy companies. We keep mentioning Uber and Lyft. They'd have to pay into workers' benefit funds so that there would be a pot of money?
Yes, there are some states that are moving towards those efforts. Our KOSH groups are particularly focused on passing legislation that's more comprehensive in terms of workers' rights that cover health and safety and prevents wage theft. We are aware that a couple of states, as you mentioned, New York and Washington, are pushing for legislation that charges a fee on gig economy transactions and put money into an independent fund to provide portable benefits that workers can access even if he or she moves from job to job. For instance, the Independent Drivers Guild is pressing this with New York City officials. Washington and New Jersey legislators introduced a bill. Virginia and Washington reps introduced a bill in Congress to issue grants for pilot programs to create portable benefits. And then states are also taking action addressing safety, wage theft, and other issues related to temp workers. A key part of our work is to advocate for strict enforcement of current safety laws, publicize workplace injuries, hazards, and fatalities, and advocate for new laws to create safer workplaces.
Look, you say safer. These are dangerous jobs. We forget how dangerous some of the gig economy jobs are. There are stats that taxi drivers and chauffeurs are killed on the job at a rate 5 times higher than the average for all workers. And after the young DoorDash delivery worker, Adewani Wright Davis, died, people were reminded that many in the gig economy are very young and they are not thinking about safety. They haven't been in the workforce very long.
Right. Young workers are particularly at risk. Young people are attracted to the flexibility provided by employers such as DoorDash. But these are also the people who are least used to employment and have little experience with job hazards. Further work-related motor vehicle crashes are the leading cause of death for young people ages 16 to 24 in the U.S. We know that temps often do not receive sufficient training, do not have enough experience to protect themselves on the job site. With little or no job security, temps are reluctant to call attention to safety issues. They have a fear of getting replaced or losing their jobs. Compared to permanent employees, temporary workers tend to be younger, less educated, and disproportionately consist of minority workers, many of whom might be immigrant workers. Immigrant workers in particularly frequently experience retaliation. You know, they have fear of retaliation if they speak up about safety or other workplace rights. Unfortunately, vulnerable workers not covered under OSHA, one group are domestic workers, and many staffing agencies seek household domestic workers for private homes.
Well, so what is your advice to people working in the gig economy?
Well, temp workers need to know if they have a right to a written job order, such as is required in Massachusetts and in Illinois, which provides them essential information about their wages, benefits, workers' comp provider, et cetera. It's also important that temp workers know that their temp agency is responsible for workers' compensation if they are injured, and that both the worksite employer and temp agency have shared responsibilities for their safety. If they have concerns about their rights, they are most vulnerable to retaliation, so they should turn to a KOSH group or workers' center to take action, ideally with coworkers.
That's Jessica Martinez, co-executive director of the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health. They're very concerned about what's happening in the gig economy, more and more people working in it, but without benefits and coverage that other workers enjoy. Jessica, it's an ongoing conversation. Thanks so much for jumping in today.
Thank you, Robin.
Experts are looking at the possible short-term and long-term impacts of the Republican tax bill that passed the Senate early Saturday morning. The House and Senate are now trying to reconcile their competing versions of the bill. No matter what happens in conference, though, the analysis suggests that the tax overhaul could add more than $1 trillion to the federal debt, loading up younger generations of Americans with even more of a bill to pay. For more on the generational impacts of the tax overhaul, we're joined now by Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
And all the analyses that we've seen look at what this tax bill means by income level. But let's take that aside for a moment and look at the generations, starting with younger people, maybe people in their 20s and 30s. What's the effect of this bill?
There are two debates here. The first debate is how much debt this bill will add, and the second debate is who will have to pay for it. So first, you have the Tax Policy Center and the Joint Tax Committee saying the bill will add at least $1 trillion in debt over the next 10 years. More conservative estimates from, say, the Tax Foundation say it'll add only, quotation marks around only, something like $500 billion. So either way, it's going to add hundreds of billions of dollars in new debt, and this is pretty controversial, to say the least, since Republicans spent 8 years criticizing Democrats for larding up the debt. On the other hand, the question is, though, who's going to pay for this? Some people say young people will pay, that due to the rising cost of providing health care to an aging population, government spending will rise with Medicare and Medicaid, and young people will have to pay for it because our debt will be growing. Some people also say that, you know, maybe the government can just float our higher debt, our higher deficits, because we'll just print money and hopefully there won't be inflation. So there's not 100% certainty here, but it certainly seems like you're going to have rising debt as the result of this bill, and that debt will, if it is borne out by any taxpayers, will be borne out by today's younger taxpayers.
And those younger taxpayers, by the way, maybe just coming out of school, maybe with a lot of student loan debt and not a lot of extra disposable income. How does this bill affect them in that way?
I wrote a long essay about the House GOP bills. The Senate bill just passed. The House GOP bill just passed before that. And I really thought like it really felt like a 360-degree attack on higher education, to be perfectly honest. It raised taxes on graduate students. It raised taxes on student debtors. But what I'm really concerned about for young people here is there's a subtle and really important way that both of these plans could make college more expensive. And that comes down to the state and local tax deduction. And this is a deduction that lots of people take in higher tax states like New York, Massachusetts, California. And one implication of killing the state and local tax deduction is that it becomes harder for states to raise taxes. What does that mean? Well, that means these states don't have as much money. They can't run deficits, so they spend less on higher education. What we've seen for the last 20 years is that as states pay less for higher education, those institutions of higher education have to charge somebody more. Right. Who's that somebody? Well, it's students. That means tuition goes up. So there is a little bit of a Rube Goldberg mechanism by which, a sort of causal mechanism by which you could see this bill resulting in higher tuition.
What about for people who are in their 40s and 50s?
For people who are middle-aged, I think it depends. If you're lower middle income, this bill is going to cut your taxes next year, but the tax cut will probably shrink over the next few years so that by the middle of the 2020s, you honestly might be paying more. If you're a really rich middle-aged person, first off, congrats. Second, double congrats, because you're about to get a really nice tax cut on your earned income, on your wages. And here's the third piece of great news. If you are rich, you have more to save, you have more to invest, and this bill is really all about helping large corporations. Its centerpiece is a new 20% marginal rate on corporate income. And those corps are going to put that money into stock buybacks and dividends. So triple congrats, your savings are going to ride the stock market to new wonderful heights. So for middle-aged people, it really depends on their income level.
But if they're rich, good for them. And maybe Indeed. They'll get even richer. What about people who are closer to retirement?
Well, their savings took a beating in the Great Recession, and the stock market has really been on a tear since about March of 2009. So if they have personal savings, that's great. This bill should be good for the stock market, and hopefully that's good for them. You know, I'm thinking about pensioners here. If they don't have savings, if they don't have income coming in, and they're just living off of annuities and Social Security payments, it's probably not going to mean much. But one point I definitely do want to make is that something the government has seen recently is that older people are working a lot more. Working a lot longer. In fact, young people think of the sharing economy as a young person's game. But in fact, the majority of new alternative workers tend to be in their 50s and 60s. So for them, it's going to be the same as for most low and middle class people with this bill. You're going to see tax cuts next year, a slightly smaller tax cut the year after that. But eventually, this bill is designed to wipe out middle class and low income tax cuts so that by the middle of the 2020s, they may be paying more.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, looking at some of the generational impacts of the tax overhaul. And of course, we will have to see what happens as it goes into conference and whether both the House and Senate are able to pass the final package. Derek, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jamie.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.